From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. As one of the journalists in David Breyer's film says, you can see the attraction for the media as armed protesters occupied the Malheur Wildlife Refuge in Oregon last year. As he put it, you had cowboys with guns taking over a bird sanctuary in the middle of a desert screaming about American tyranny. So part of Breyer's film is the sheer spectacle of the siege, which played out over 41 days. Breyer's was embedded with the occupiers. So the film, on one hand, is this intimate and humane portrait of these people, but it's also a critique of an insurrection that had principles and a sense of fury, but no actual plan. As another observer explains, they weren't actually looking for answers, just a deeper immersion into a utopian fantasy. The film is called No Man's Land. We're talking about it after the news.
Hey there, podcast listener. I'm Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. If you enjoy the show, we'd appreciate it if you did us a little favor. Find us on the iTunes store and leave us a review. Let us know what you think. It's valuable feedback for us, and frankly, the more reviews we have, the more listeners we can attract. Thanks in advance. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. David Byer's documentary film offers an extraordinary view of last year's standoff between armed protesters and the federal government at the Malheur Wildlife Refuge outside of Burns, Oregon. You'll remember the occupation was led in part by Ammon Bundy, the son of rancher Cliven Bundy, who staged his own standoff with federal authorities at his ranch in southern Nevada. The film tracks the beginnings of the Malheur siege, also the motives that got it started. It explores the spectacle of it, the behavior of the media, the way the protesters managed their message. Byers was given incredible access to the inner workings of these protesters, and he has said that as he covered all of this, he didn't think they were demons, just people who truly cared about something. And it was more than just public land that they cared about. He said it was an idea that Byers found hard to pin down, actually, in the film. The film is called No Man's Land. We're going to be screening it as part of our documentary film series next week. David Byers is joining us today to talk about it. He directed and produced the film, and we'll give you details about the screening a little bit later. As I said, he's joining us today from a studio on the campus of California State University, Northridge. And David Byers, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Doug.
Well, we should start with what got you started thinking about this. And this goes back, for you anyway, to I think it was the spring of 2014. This is when you started paying attention to this kind of, what, patriot movement, I guess.
It did, yeah. In May of 2014, Phil Lyman, as a county commissioner in southern Utah, organized a ATV ride to protest the closure of a federal road there in southern Utah. And so I had gotten wind that the Bundys, who had just come off their perceived victory at Bunkerville, were going to be there as well. And ever since the Bunkerville standoff, I had been fascinated with this topic. So I kind of jumped at the chance to go down there and hopped in a car with an audio guy and cameraman, Jim Hurst. And we went down there and we documented this thing. And, you know, it seems like a very small thing. The road closure was like, it was a very small road closure. You could still ride your bike. You could still drive a herd of cattle down that road if you wanted to, but you just weren't allowed to drive motorized vehicles over it. So, you know, it was very obvious that, like, this was just a talisman of a larger frustration with the federal government and with, you know, the federal government feeling out of touch for these people at large.
What was it that interested you about Bunkerville before and then Recapture Canyon and then Malheur? I mean, what intrigued you about that, basically?
You know, I was living in Southwest Colorado at the time, and I grew up in Georgia. So this kind of concept of federal lands was something that I just had no idea about. You know, more than 50% of the land west of the Mississippi is managed by the federal government. And we just didn't have that in Georgia. So for me, like, this was such a big, crazy thing. And then to see folks, you know, essentially saying, you know, the federal government has too much power. They're saying that this is crazy. You know, we should have more local control and whatnot. And so, for me, the paradigm of of federal land was what really kind of drew me to this thing. And the fact that there were these very iconic conflicts going on. I mean, these were cowboys. This is so part of our, you know, the fabric of America is, yeah. You know, every little boy grows up, you know, dressing like a cowboy or playing cowboys at some point, you know. So that's what kind of drew me to this whole confluence of events.
It's interesting how you really humanize these guys. You don't look at them, even though a lot of people did or may have along the line looked at them as Al-Qaeda was one of those sort of dismissive terms used for these guys. And all the camo and all the weapons, and it could be easy. I mean, you could dismiss that kind of thing, but you don't really do that in the film. While it's a critique, mm-hmm. It's also fair, and you kind of humanize them. And I wanted you to talk about your intent for that, what you wanted to show with these guys.
Sure. Well, you know, it's Hal Herring who appears in the film. It's one of my favorite journalists. He says, ridicule is a mighty, mighty thing, gruel. And, you know, I don't think, and you know, you say I'm humanizing these people, but they're human beings, you know, that with their nobility and their foibles mm-hmm. all together. And, you know, for me, I have my own opinions about politics and public lands, but I didn't want to make any kind of documentary that merely preached to the choir, because I don't think that really moves the needle on anything. I think that what we've achieved in a very negative way in our country is this divisiveness, where not only you say, I disagree with you, but because I disagree with you, you're either an idiot or you're evil. Yeah. And I think that that's been very harmful to our, you know, to our discourse, and whether it's politics or just talking to your neighbor. We've been able to silo ourselves into our own echo chamber so effectively through social media and through only surrounding ourselves through those, you know, agreeable voices, mm-hmm. that we've really lost sight of what it means to actually work within a democracy and work with your neighbor in terms of finding solutions to real problems.
It's interesting. You've talked about how you grew up on one side of the political spectrum, and then you made a kind of transition where you came to the other side of the political spectrum. Mm-hmm. And I guess that helped you in terms of the way you talked to these people, the way you covered this story, the way you made the film, probably.
I mean, yeah, absolutely. I'm not uncomfortable around conservatives. You know, a lot of people, you know, working in Brooklyn or California or wherever, you know, I've been around people who are uncomfortable, like engaging with conservatives. And again, it comes down to you know, finding ourselves in these intellectually gated communities and choosing these gated communities for ourselves. And so for me, growing up around conservatives and, you know, now being what I would call a liberal, I really, you know, the conservatives are just people with different ideology, and you might find it distasteful, but you have to drill down and see that you all have the same common values. You know, I think that that's not a liberal conservative thing. I think that's a universal thing, is that we all have, when you drill down deep enough, we all have the same values. And then it's when we kind of, I hesitate to use the word elevate the conversation, but when we get into the higher levels of ideology and ideologues and, you know, especially politics, is when things get ugly.
Let's talk about Hal Herring. For those who don't know who he is kind of amazing. And we've had him on the show before. That's why I can say that. And he's an amazing voice in the West because of his wisdom. It seems to me that's the right mm-hmm. word that comes to mind for Hal Herring. And he is kind of one of the voices, anyway, of reason, if not the voice. Is that a good way to put the role that you think,
you know,
for Hal Herring?
The way I like to look at the film is, you know, the occupiers are kind of the id of America, mm-hmm. and Hal's the ego and superego of America. You know, he's the one who brings it up to a higher intellectual mode of thought and is not just reacting. And that comes from, he is a, you know, a voracious student of the human condition and of everything.
Yeah.
Like, he's very knowledgeable about public lands. He's knowledgeable about history. He he sees it with a clarity of vision that not a whole lot of people do, and because he takes it to such a cerebral level, but also, you know, a very real level and a very pragmatic level. He leaves the emotionality of the issues out of it.
Yeah.
And a lot of times he posits very unpopular theories, but a lot of times he's right, you know. And also he's a man who recognizes nuance.
Right.
And I'm not sure if he says it in the film, but he's said this to me before, but, you know, it's very attractive to deal in absolutes. And I think that's so profound, and it's not only attractive, but it's a huge pitfall, because once you decide that something is some certain way and never shall that change, is when you've kind of lost, you've lost any way forward, you've lost any kind of possibility for a solution. And I think that's what Hal brings to this, is he brings this incredible intellect and this knowledge, deep knowledge of the West and also of the human condition.
I want people to hear him. We'll hopefully hear various clips, in fact, throughout the hour today. But let's start with this moment where Hal talks about what interested him about this occupation.
I've been writing about public lands conflicts for most of my life now. I went to the Malheur hoping to find a explanation for the rural raids that I had witnessed over two decades and a plan, even if I didn't agree with it. I wanted to hear it.
One of the things the film does so well is to work through this idea of whether, in fact, the protesters did have a plan, like Hal puts it, or whether they just wanted to say something. And even further still, whether what they had to say was coherent or true or, you know, actually justified what they were doing. What do you make of that?
You know, I think the Bundys had a very specific vision for this, which is, you know, federal lands belong to the states and ultimately private interests. The occupiers, however, had more of an amalgamation of motivations for being there. And in terms of a plan, this is where the kind of amalgamation of motivations gets into it, is that, you know, they just wanted to be heard, because the one thing that they all had in common was that none of them felt that they were being listened to by anyone with authority. And I think that's something we can all identify with as Americans, you know, over the past, you know, since I have become political, you know, I'm 35, you know. But in terms of an actual plan, they just wanted to get their message out. And it was a bit of a paradox, because they wanted to get their message out, yet they were very wary of the media, and rightfully so in many cases. You know, there were so many people there just trying to get them to say the craziest thing on camera and post it to YouTube or put it on the nightly news and say, well, there you have it, a bunch of crazy dudes hanging out in Oregon right now. And, you know, I think in terms of a plan, concrete, I think this thing blew up into a media circus that they couldn't have anticipated. Right. And so they were kind of winging it, and they had no exit plan. And I think that's where the real danger in this situation was present, and that there was an immovable object and an unstoppable force.
Yeah.
You know, the occupation said they weren't going to leave. And obviously the FBI has to get these people off of this federal land and out of these federal facilities.
One of the most fascinating parts of the film is the kind of exploration about the spectacle of it all. And it almost seems like there was a performance aspect to all of this, not to undermine what were legitimate grievances, of course, but a lot of it did seem at times kind of contrived, a little melodramatic. Here's Hal Herring again from the film, and he talks about that kind of circus atmosphere.
Because I live my life in the rural West, I have this kind of regional contempt for spectacle. And I didn't see that skepticism applied by the media that showed up every morning to enjoy the Ammon Bundy show.
Turn to us, please. Turn to us. Thank you.
And call upon all those who love freedom to come and support this effort in the way that they feel they should.
They understood how to use the media and how to present their best face. The gun-toting, justice-seeking cowboy, the man of the land.
What do you think about that? Was it a performance of sort on the part of some of the players?
Yeah, I do. I would say go in further than that. And I would say it was a symbiosis between the media and the occupiers. You know, the occupation didn't exist without the media, and the media wouldn't be there without the occupation. You know, it's they definitely were, you know, channeling Thomas Paine and the founding fathers for the cameras to, you know, to present this noble face, and the media was just eating it up. You know, like I think you quoted it earlier, Les Seitz, another wonderful reporter from who used to write for the Oregonian. He said, you know, you've got cowboys in the middle of the desert in winter in Oregon on a bird sanctuary screaming about American liberty. You know, this was, They truly did believe in what they were saying, but also they were very much performing for the cameras in terms of, you know, they knew they needed the cameras for this occupation to be a thing. And I think that was very calculated on their part, and also just very human. You know, you're mugging for the camera, you know. So,
well, Les talks about how it seemed fairly, these press events seemed pretty scripted. Mm-hmm. And that the idea, he said you could tell is they were trying to keep themselves in the news and they wanted to control the agenda because, and we'll come back to this a little bit later in the conversation, but it's like when there wasn't much to say anymore to the media, that's when the story starts to turn a bit.
Yeah, you know, they would have these kind of events for the press. So they would invite the press, and they went and cut, you know, a fence on refuge property that you know, kept a rancher's cattle from getting onto refuge property. The rancher was none too happy about that.
Right,
even though the Bundys said that, you know, the rancher supported that. And then they, you know, they had, there was a big shed that they, you know, made a big to-do about cleaning out and invited the media. And we're talking about how, like, you know, it's how poorly managed this place was and stuff like that. So they were really, you know, I guess the press was showing up every day and being like, okay, what's next? What's next? What's next? What's next? You know,
it seems so silly. Some of it, like there was a moment when, for example, they climbed to the top of a telephone pole to get rid of some surveillance cameras,
right?
Which were just security cameras to, you know, whatever. And they, you know, and the spectacle they made of that seemed a little overwrought. I thought that was really interesting too.
Yeah, well, you know, the kind of irony of that is you're taking over a federal facility and then wondering why the feds are looking at you.
Right,
you know,
right.
And again, it was, it had they just been ranchers on a ranch and then the feds had set up surveillance cameras to surveil them for whatever their ideology was, that would be, you know, terrible. And I get behind that. But at the same time, they were taking over federal facilities. And so, yeah, and there were these events that they would invite the press to try to control the narrative, kind of poke at the federal government, you know, throw shade at the federal government whenever possible. And, you know, these little physical kind of symbols or acts or plays of their resistance to what they perceived as the aggression of the United States federal government.
Yeah. While we're on this subject, it did seem they were pretty savvy about manipulating the media, I have to say. And we should mention one of the really fascinating characters in this story, Pete Santilli.
Yes.
Just talk a little bit about him. He's an extraordinary guy too.
Yeah. You know, to answer your first point, they were incredibly savvy, but at the same time, the media was there to just eat it up, you know, for the most part. You know, there were folks asking hard questions as well, but for the most part, people were just there to turn the cameras on and let them have their say, because this is this crazy thing that's happening, you know, and it's very iconic, this thing that's happening. Now, in terms of Pete Santilli, You know, I had been following him for a couple of years while I was doing this, looking at people who were active in kind of this patriot movement and the militia movement. And he, you know, is a radio host that self-styled kind of voice of this movement. Yeah. There are many of these people, but he was definitely the loudest at the Malheur. You know, I started following him when he did this thing called the Border Convoy when he was going down. I don't know if you remember this, but they had like a bunch of children refugees from Guatemala in southern Texas, and they were being held in these facilities, and he was leading a convoy down there. And there was all this fear-mongering about them having like typhoid and flu and stuff like that. And he was leading a border convoy to go down there to like protest this thing. That's how he first came on my radar. But he did become... by virtue of being the loudest, you know, and also, you know, providing this window into this event and or to this ongoing occupation as it's unfolding, he did become the de facto voice of this thing. Whereas, you know, Ammon, Bundy, or Lavoie Finicum, or whoever would come up for the press briefings in the morning and then go into endless meetings all day, which no one really knew what they were about. He was constantly live streaming and getting a ton of views. And that's, you know, how a lot of the support was rallied for this thing as well online. And that's, you know, something that's really amazing to me as well, is this is very much an occupation that happened at a physical place, but it also happened on social media. And we've never seen that before. You know, we've, like in America at least, you know, it's happened all over the place elsewhere. But, you know, imagine Waco with Facebook, you know, or live streaming to YouTube. You know, this is what this thing was. And it was such a throwback in terms of, you know, the folks who were there and the image they were trying to present. But it was also incredibly modern in that it unfolded via the internet as well, you know.
David Byers is with us. His film is called No Man's Land. Next Wednesday night, we're going to be screening it at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. This is, of course, part of our Through the Lens series on documentary film. It's our partnership with the Utah Film Center. David and two of the film's producers, David Holbrook and Stash Wislocki, are going to join us for a Q&A after the film, so you should come. But come early. First come, first serve is sort of how it works. We have details about it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're profiling the film No Man's Land. It's a firsthand account of the occupation last year of the Malheur Wildlife Refuge in Oregon by armed protesters. For 41 days, these protesters, some of whom were ranchers, some were right-wing militia members, they occupied this refuge as an act of defiance of the federal government. The director, David Byers, is joining us to talk about the film, which we're screening next Wednesday night. We'll give you more details about that a little bit later on the program. Is embedded the right word to describe your relationship with these guys and how you covered this?
I mean, that's like the sexiest way to describe it. You know, I spent a lot of time with these guys. Yeah. You know, embedded, whatever your definition of it was. I spent some nights out there in my car. I'd spent a lot of nights in a hotel in Burns, but I spent just as much time as I could with these guys as possible. And that was kind of the as possible part is important because they were trying to kick people out a lot of times and trying to manage where the media went and whatnot. And so for me, that I knew that, or I, you know, I had an inkling that the access was going to be very important for this. And
did they think of you as a media?
You know, I think I occupied some sort of mezzanine space in their minds between just a normal onlooker and curious dude and the media, because I wasn't putting out anything ever. I was just recording. I wasn't uploading to YouTube or putting out nightly news or anything like that. So I think that differentiated me from the media. And I was also really interested in talking to them as people and understanding their motivations for being there. And a lot of times, you know, I'd say, I'm interested in talking to you and understanding why you're here. And they thought a lot of that was a little too touchy-feely. But at the same time, you know, that's what's interesting to me. And I think, you know, having real conversations to them was something that they responded to, because again, they were there to be listened to. They were at this facility because they felt that they weren't being listened to. And in a lot of cases, they were right. And I was, you know, lending an ear, you know, a sympathetic ear. You know, there were a lot of, I guess you would call them, islands of common ground mm-hmm. that we could, talk about.
Right.
And, you know, I made a point to never lie to these guys, and I never wanted to misrepresent myself or why I was there. But, you know, I wanted to talk about things that we agreed about, because, you know, documentary filmmaking is a bit of a rarefied liberal place.
Yeah.
And I knew that this documentary was going to hopefully be seen by a bunch of folks who are going to be predominantly liberal. And I wanted them to, you know, understand that these were people, mm-hmm. you know, and then if I could just provide a window outside of one's own echo chamber for a minute, and I think that would, you know, help, at least in terms of, you don't have to agree with these guys, but you at least have to understand that, like, that they're people, and they have, and maybe that their solutions are wrong to you, and maybe you disagree with them, but at the same time, there are some of their pain, or at least some of their pain, is real mm-hmm. and is legitimate.
Hal Herring describes the kind of general atmosphere, at least in those early days, as a freshman debate team atmosphere. You had lots of camaraderie and people bringing in groceries for these guys and sharing, as Hal put it, cigarettes and stories. And mm-hmm. And you were there for, you know, for a lot of that. You were also there. It seems like their guard was down a bit as they were doing some of their military training, which mm-hmm. they seemed really earnest about. And that was another really fascinating part of all of this. Let me play another moment. This is Linda Tirado. She's another mm-hmm. journalist covering this. She was one of those journalists. I got a sense of among the few who are actually serious about the story or are looking at something more interesting. Mm-hmm. Les Sates, you mentioned, of course, Hal Herring, obviously. But Linda here talks about kind of the general sense of who these people were.
They're plumbers and pipe fitters and McDonald's workers and kind of all sorts, which was fascinating for me, because who else cares about mineral rights in rural Oregon besides ranchers? But it wasn't about ranching. They are losing ground, and real wages haven't risen, and nobody can get real work. And then Ammon Bundy shows up and said, yes, you have been getting gaslit for most of your life, and I can help you fix it.
People weren't looking for answers. They were looking for a deeper immersion in anti-government militancy. When you're out of a job, when your 401k is crashed, the kids may not have shoes, but I am in the service of a larger good, that of American liberty. It's empowering for people who felt they were finally being listened to.
Let's talk about one of those people, another fascinating character in this story, Jason Patrick.
Mm-hmm.
Les Sites called this a stew of right-wing militants, and they all had different motives, so it was hard to make sense of, because the motives were all clashing. And Jason Patrick, on one hand, he fits in completely, but then on the other hand, he's kind of against militancy. He has, you know, he has this issue with the Vietnam War and his father, who got cancer mm-hmm. through Agent Orange. He's a really interesting character, and it just shows how different these people could be, too.
Yeah, and that's why, you know, I'm so glad that, like, we had Jason Patrick for this film, because I think he shows how truly, you know, human these people are, and, like, how not one-sided they are, and how, like, round of characters they are. You know, these are deeply complex human beings, just like everyone else is, and his motivations for being there were maybe a little bit different than other folks, but he had legitimate reasons for being there. And then, you know, like everyone else, he had reasons that, you know, don't, that drew a little bit more up into to politics and ideology. But, you know, he's a smart guy, you know. He's intelligent, he's well-spoken, and he could put together a coherent sentence and really, you know, make his case. And, you know, secondly, he has this deeply personal story of why he distrusts the federal government that's absolutely legitimate. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't argue with that.
Yeah.
And then, you know, on the third, he's a politically awake person. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, a lot of these folks, had they just been nudged a different way, like somewhere along their development, that they would have turned out very differently.
Yeah. Talk about Lavoie Finicum. He's another mm-hmm. really interesting guy. And he's a contrast in some ways to Jason. He's really mm-hmm. charismatic. And you got a sense, yes, if you watch the coverage, he is folksy and pleasant seeming, and, you know, whether you agreed with him or not, he seemed like a kind of a good guy. I mean, he comes to a tragic end, of course, as some people will know, but Hal Herring calls him the icon of the, you know, the kind of the cowboy taking down the despised federal government. What did you make of Lavoie?
You know, you say he's charismatic and folksy and a nice guy, and he is. And those things are real as well. You know, that's him. He is a bit mugging for the camera, but that, when it comes down to it, like, that's who he is.
Yes.
He is a nice guy. He's trying to do well for his family. You know, he just, something, I keep on quoting Hal, but something touched a nerve in him,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Something touched a nerve in him at Bunkerville, where he saw, you know, Clive and Bunny making a stand. And that, you know, I think, yeah, you know, just as like a person living in the United States, I think, you know, modern life is very emasculating when you look at the past through rose-colored glasses. You know, when men were men, and you could, you know, justice was served at the end of a gun, mm-hmm. and you could, you know, and I think that also ignores, you know, the fact that life was brutish and short.
Right.
Back then as well. But at the same time, you know, when you view that past and you feel emasculated and you see this noble purpose, you know, what's more powerful than that to join? And I think that he really fell under that spell.
You don't really deal with the question of religion per se, but God is, you know, comes up all the time in these, mm-hmm. When people talk, and there's a lot of praying. Lavoie was Mormon, of course. Ammon Bundy, Mormon, his brother Randy, mm-hmm. Mormon. There was a kind of religious sensibility. And I just wanted to get your sense of what you noticed about the religious flavor of all of that.
Oh, you know, that was a can of worms, you know, in a rabbit hole that could last forever, you know. And, you know, I think people use religion to justify all sorts of things. And I think that that's a very, you know, if you start from your ideology and then you work backwards to form a baseline of religion, then you feel much more secure in your beliefs. And I think that's what happens whenever you see, you know, religion being used as a backstop for some sort of, ideology that I think for the most part does not spring from religion, and the religious basis for it, you know, works backwards from the ideology, which is obviously, if you are presenting the religious base as truth is a backwards way to work.
Let's talk about the town of Burns. Mm-hmm. The town itself is almost a character, although it's represented by some great, characters themselves. Steve Grasty, the county judge, mm-hmm. In Burns, and Dave Ward, the county sheriff. There's a moment, there's a town meeting at the, I'm guessing it's at the gym at the high school. Is that, am I right?
Yes.
Yeah. And there's a young girl there. The whole town is gathered, it seems, and they're just talking about what we're going to do about these protesters who are not just there in the refuge, but of course wandering around town. And there's a young girl at this kind of emotional moment talking about how she shouldn't have to feel afraid in the hometown because in her hometown because some people did feel that way. Talk about that part of this story, because their perspective is really interesting too.
Yeah, you know, I've spent times in the rural South, a lot of time in the rural South, not so much in the rural, well, a good bit of time in the rural West. But, you know, one thing in common is that when it comes down to it, these people are very pragmatic and practical. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for them to see this very, and then also these aren't the kind of people they're going to normally seek out the spotlight in any kind of outrageous way. And for them to see this very, you know, ostentatious, very flashy, you know, and dangerous thing happening on their doorstep. For them, I think it was just, they didn't know what to think of it, you know, and I think a very common sentiment, in Burns was, no, thank you. We don't need this occupation. However, yes, we do have issues, and thank you for bringing you know, attention to these things. Yeah. So it was kind of a double-edged sword for them, this occupation was. and, you know, also the Mahir Refuge and it is kind of a model for cooperation between ranchers and the federal government. So I think, in a way, the Bundys misjudged the temperature in terms of the prevailing sentiment in town.
Yeah. Let me play a moment from the film. This is Steve Grassday. I mentioned he's a county judge in Burns. And he's there at this gathering. I was really impressed at the gathering, I have to say. It seems like he let everyone have their say, or at least I got a sense of it in the way you cut that moment. And here he is. We'll hear him a bit. Initially at that gathering, but also when he was talking to David Byers.
There's no way to deny that the only reason this county, and perhaps it's me, represent this county, has the limelight and has hold of the mic is because a bunch of armed thugs in our community gets enough limelight that we have, I think I counted 13 film cameras here, so.
We had no idea what Bundy's next move might be. He wasn't communicating. He wasn't telling anybody what he was going to do. And he did have arms everywhere he went. Made sense to close the school.
In the small town of Burns, the nearest populated area, schools are closed all week. Residents growing weary. Police have turned the high school into a makeshift command center.
We got 40 or 50 guns, law enforcement, inside the building. We got 30 or 40 guys with masks on out in front of the building, in the middle of, forgive me, but my town. I'm thinking, what are we doing?
He's a great character. And we should mention Dave Ward as well, the county sheriff, who plays he's a really interesting figure too, because he has his own deep relationship with the government. He was in the military. He served in Afghanistan, he said, in Somalia. Mm-hmm. And as he's quite clear, he wants these people to go home.
Right. You know, Dave Ward is one of my producers. Like, it just, like, almost tears up every time she sees Dave Ward on screen, because he's such a good guy. You know, he was an elected sheriff. He was recently elected to sheriff, but he became sheriff when the previous sheriff retired, and he was sheriff. And then all of a sudden he is, you know, faced with this giant thing that's happening right on his doorstep. And, you know, the Patriot Movement, the militia, have this this kind of theory that the sheriff is the highest law of the land. And so they put pressure on him, and the expectation for them was that he would tell the feds to go home when he would protect the occupiers. And that was obviously not going to happen. So here he is, like, being vilified by the militia. And also, you know, a lot of people all thought he wasn't acting with a firm enough hand to get these people out of there. So he is really just this embattled man who's a really good man who's just trying to do what's right and not trying to do the politic thing, not trying to do the thing that's going to save his own hide, but really do the right thing for the town of Burns.
I wish I was a polished public speaker. I wish I was better at a lot of things. We've got some stuff to work through here. My goal is and has been from the beginning to find a peaceful resolution to this. There is an hourglass and it's running and time's going to run out. So we need to work through this sooner than later. Please go home. Thank you.
I can tell you, I felt like I felt wronged when I saw people waving the American flag around and breaking the law at the same time, screaming that they were patriots. You know, I did serve in Afghanistan and I served in Somalia. I spent many years in an army uniform. They absolutely stepped out to show themselves as that domestic threat that I did swear an oath to protect the people from.
That's Dave Ward from the documentary film No Man's Land. We're talking with the film's director, David Byers, which we're screening the film next week. It's part of our Through the Lens series on documentary film, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. David Byers is going to be here next week. That's next Wednesday, along with two of the film's producers, David Holbrook and Stash Wislocki, for a Q&A after the film. It's the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in downtown Salt Lake City. It's at 7 o'clock, though you're going to need to come early. You can get details about all of it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with David Byers. He directed and produced the documentary film No Man's Land, which we're going to be screening next Wednesday night. So I want to ask you about when the feds actually do show up, which they do enforce. The FBI shows up, and there was a time when, and this is part of the film, there's a kind of critique about whether the federal government did this right, whether in southern Nevada in the Clive and Bundy standoff, if they had emboldened Ammon, you know, that's a big part of the film. But how does the story change when the feds show up at Malheur?
Oh, goodness. You know, when the feds showing up, it became much more of a serious situation. You know, The freshman debate team atmosphere was certainly subdued. Mm-hmm. You know, there was a shadow, a pall cast over this entire thing that this was very real and this could very well turn violent. And there were a lot of kind of reports that the feds were just, you know, just over the next hill or at night, you know, just where the dark was, the feds were there. And it was plausible, you know, that there was a FBI, you know, base set up at the airport, you know, near Burns. And they were heavily armed and they did have, you know, drones and you know, the Bearcats and the MRAPs and, you know, the big weapons. But, you know, and the occupiers were also, you know, armed with AR-15s and sniper rifles. And, you know, there was allegedly a 50 caliber machine gun in there as well. This was a situation that could turn very violent. You know, this wasn't a case of, you know, the feds being able to like any other protest, go in and like beat them up with batons and then pepper spray them and then like wrap it up and be done with it, you know? Yeah. And I think that there was intentionally so on the part of the occupiers, you know, they, I talked to Ammon Bundy and he said, you know, I've seen, you know, policemen line up protesters and pepper spray them and, you know, put them in handcuffs and lead them away. And he's like, that's not us. That's not going to happen here. Yeah.
What do you think they expected in real terms? Because there's the moment very early in the film when one of the occupiers says, well, they'll probably kill us. And you're not sure if that's hyperbole or if, in fact, that's true. I mean, the journalist Linda mentions that she does wonder if some of them hadn't thought that they were when they went up to Mel, you're going to die, that they were kind of ready to be martyrs for their cause.
Sure. You know, my personal opinion is that it's really difficult for any person to understand the profundity of not existing, and I don't think we can fully contemplate that. You know, it's hard for me to do because all I know is me existing. So for me to truly say I'm going to do something and it might result in my death, I think there's an inkling. There has to be like an inkling, like some sort of psychological, backdoor that says I can survive this, you know, and or I won't die. You know, this is fine. And so I think there was a lot of talk about death, but I don't. And maybe they were. Maybe these are people that are made of different stuff than I am. Maybe they really could deeply and profoundly and realistically contemplate their own death. But for me, that's a tough one. I really think that in order to not be paralyzed with fear, we have to at least see, you know, no pun intended, but the light at the end of the tunnel, you know?
Yeah.
But in a non-dying kind of way.
Right. Well, but it's interesting too that you see, as you chronicle in the film, they really start to work themselves into a lather. They tell each other that we need to take us. And you show that you're here in these meetings with them as they talk about it's time for us to take a stand. And this is really when the arc of the film starts to get tense. It starts to really build and you figure something is going to happen. And of course it does. As everyone knows by now, the leadership of this group, they get into this convoy to go 100 miles away to the city of John Day. And of course law enforcement knows where they're going. They set up a roadblock, and in the process LaVoy Finicum, as people know from reading the news, is shot and killed. Now Hal Herring says in the film, he says that this kind of certitude, the certitude that was expressed by these protesters, almost demands blood sacrifice to justify itself. I'm not sure if he was saying that he knew something like this would happen, but that could be a result. Just talk about this moment, and there's some dramatic footage. I wanted to play just a bit of it to give people a sense of just the real drama of the moment that you portray in the film. Here's that. Let me just play this. This is the moment. Do you want to set this up for us, David Byers? I mean, this is, we're in the car. LaVoy Finicum is driving the car. They've been stopped. They're Randy Bundy is in the back seat. There are some women there. And at this moment, do you need to say anything about this? There's a moment when LaVoy's going to make a run for it.
Yeah. You know, they had been stopped by law enforcement. There were four people in the car at that moment. And, you know, LaVoy says, I'm going to go. You know, we shouldn't have stopped, and we're going to go.
They know there's no service here at all.
We should never have stopped.
I'm going to keep going.
Then we have to duck.
I know.
What are they going to do with people. Ryan?
Okay.
If we take
we
off,
need to get Ryan
shoot,
back.
Shoot your tires out.
I'm going to go. You guys ready?
Okay, get down.
Then you duck down. Give me that camera. Please. Okay, give me this camera. Go.
Are they shooting?
Got it.
Yeah.
Hey, okay, they're shooting.
Hey,
okay, we're down.
It just gives you a sense of a little bit of that moment. It's incredibly dramatic. What can you say about this particular moment in the film?
You know, I think this is where everything kind of came to a head. And I think this is where, you know, the leadership was in two cars. The first car had already been pulled over and stopped, and they had all been arrested. The second car was pulled over. In pure pragmatic sense, this was a tactical error in terms of the leadership, to put your leadership in two cars and go, you know, 100-mile stretch of road that has no cell phone reception and big snowbanks on either side. I think for the feds, this was the perfect opportunity, their only opportunity that had, you know, arisen wherein they could, you know, safely or try to take the leadership into custody. Mm-hmm. I'm never gonna like revel in a man's death. You know, I think it's sad, and I think that any time, you know, a man's life is, or a person's life is taken by law enforcement or our government in any form, you know, I think that we should all pause for reflection and see where we went wrong, because I think that somewhere along the way we did go wrong.
Yeah.
No matter who it is.
Let me ask you finally, we're about out of time, but I wanted to have you reaction to what do you want to say about the reaction when Finnecum is killed? Because it seems like now, you know, as Hal Herring says, the Pied Piper's gone. All the leaders are arrested. There was no grand heroic stand. And he says, basically, these people were left then bereft. Would you just, in the 30 seconds or so we have left, say something about that finally? Because I think that was really profound.
Yeah, you know, the leadership was gone and these guys were left holding the bill. And a lot of them are going to jail now. The leadership for their parts in the Malheur was acquitted. And I think that that's it's such a metaphor for the state of America right now, is that it's the common man who suffers and not the people who are the ones maybe being reckless with their ideology or encouraging other people to do so.
It's David Byers. He's a documentary film director. His film is called No Man's Land, which we're screening next Wednesday night as part of our Through the Lens series. David and some producers of the film will be joining us. You can get details about it on our website, radiowest.org. David, we'll see you next week. Thanks very much for doing this.
Thanks, Doug. Looking forward to it.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Technical direction today from Tim Slover. Zoe Wolf-McGinn is our intern. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.